You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Thanks, everybody. My name is Chris Babbitts. I'm Assistant Director of the Cyber Law Clinic, which is a clinical program here at the center affiliated with HLS. And we've gotten to know the Open Court team, Joe Spur, John David Au, and Val Wong, really well over the last year or so, I guess, as we and our students have had the privilege of getting to work with them on this great project. I think without further ado, I'll just turn it over to you guys, and you can dive in. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, I'll sort of name the players so we can get it all straight. I'm John David Au. I'm the Executive Director of Open Court. This is Joe Spur to my left. He's the director of it. And this is Val Wong, who's our reporter, who we've all been working together on this since a year ago, November. So we're actually in the middle of our anniversary. So happy anniversary to all of us. And what a great way to celebrate it is having this invitation to talk about it before the Berkman Center and everybody else who's out there in cyberland. It's sort of odd to have the cameras turned on the live streamers, and now we know what we're putting everybody through. So it's taken this long to get to that point. Let me just make a few opening remarks about Open Court. We'd love this conversation to be free-flowing, so feel free to jump in at any time. And we're here to really get your input and your ideas about how we can take this project forward from this point. Open Court started as a Knight News Challenge winner in 2010. It was funded by the Knight Foundation. We are based out of WBUR, where I have my day job. Boston University has been incredibly supportive of our efforts, and it's been a real privilege to work with Joe and Val throughout this whole thing. The whole idea behind the project is to bring digital transparency to the nation's courts. One of the things that we were struck by is the fact that of the three branches, the courts are somewhat behind the executive branch and the legislative branch. Don't forget that C-SPAN started long ago. We have a president who used social media quite effectively to get his message out even during his campaign. And the courts, in many ways, even though the founders determined that justice would be done in public, they have sort of enjoyed sort of I'm not sure the best term of it. There is a term, and I'm just blanking on it. But
private by obscurity.
Thank you. You want to say that louder for everybody?
Privacy by obscurity,
and that you actually have to be in the court to see it. And lives have gotten more busy over time. People have gotten further and further removed from the courts. There used to be these things called reporters, who used to go to the courts, and they would tell the public, and they were the bridge to the public of what was going on in the court. There's less of us around, and we saw this as an opportunity to sort of leverage some of the tools and technology that many of us have in our pockets, smartphones, to get the message and reconnect the public to the courts. I always sort of refer back to
the next slide.
To Kill a Mockingbird, where the entire town pours into the court. And that was sort of the idea, sort of in a nutshell, of what we wanted to do with Open Court. We started going live on May 2nd. We provide a live Wi-Fi feed. We're essentially the C-SPAN of it. We want to get more people involved as much as possible. And, you know, Joe and Val will be talking more about that. I think it's better often to show what we're doing as opposed to talk about what we're doing. And let's just sort of go to a standard video of what a day at Quincy District Court looks like.
Mr. Morrissey, could you stand, please? 11560-4726, Logie charging with operating in the influence of liquor, third offense in the city of Quincy on August 30th, 2011. The court enters a plea of not guilty on your behalf.
Mr. Morrissey, you have the right to have a lawyer represent you. If you cannot afford one, sir, the court can appoint one for you. Do you understand that?
Yes.
Camera right now, we're only in one camera in one courtroom in Massachusetts. This is a demonstration project. The idea is to sort of develop best practices and come up with ways for other courts around the country to learn from what we're learning about bringing access to the courts. So it's a very simple process that goes on for 6 to 8 hours a day. And what we find is that we have a sort of a steady cohort of viewers. And at certain times, though, we have a lot more viewers. And this is an example of that. In Quincy District Court, a couple of weeks ago, a young man was accused of murdering his mother, his mother's boyfriend, and his sister. And this is basically the routine kind of local television coverage where the media dives in and dives out right after the hearing. And we were there, and it was very similar to, you know, we're set up in the same place really where the camera pool is set up, but the idea was to make that accessible to the public. What the public didn't see was what happened 2 months ago at his arraignment when he was in court. And let Val just play that.
I'm turning your eyes to the facts in the new case. On Wednesday, September 7th, Quincy police responded to residents where the victims in that matter, mother and daughter, indicated that Mr. Rudolph was coming looking from to collect a debt for drug money that was owed to him by one of the victims in this case. It said since owing that money, there have been numerous incidents involving their finding their cat dead with a screwdriver placed through its head in the rear of their residence, that screens were cut, and on the day in question here when police arrived, it was reported that he was kicking the rear gate, trying to open a gate.
So what Open Court was able to do, and we feel like in many ways this is the power of Open Court, it contextualized what was going on the day that the people came in. We were able to access our video through our archives, which any member of the public can do. We archive all of our hearings, and we were able to sort of demonstrate and create some accountability on the part of the judges, as well as to demonstrate some of the challenges there are that face the courts on a daily basis. I think Val could talk about sort of how this video was used and sort of what was what was accomplished by what we were doing.
So the video was taken up by Fox as well as WGBH's Greater Boston in different stories. This was much more local, the Fox one. The WGBH, they brought in a forensic psychologist to talk about, because the young man had a lot of mental health history, which was brought out in the arraignment 2 months ago that we saw. So they brought in a forensic psychologist to talk about sort of the greater web of social services that are supposed to catch people like this and help them, and, you know, how did this person fall through the cracks? So it became a bigger conversation, not just about the courts, but about the whole web of social services of which the court is one part. So we thought that was interesting that they could use our footage to start a conversation about the court and about social services.
And it actually provided video that they never would have had, or a context that they never would have had without Open Court. And, you know, the idea is every court, you know, at least that's the belief of Open Court, should have access to this kind of record. So.
Okay. And then Quincy also runs a drug court, which is a program in which people who are convicted of crimes and who have addiction problems can register instead of going to jail. They register in this 18-month intensive program where they have to come in and stand before the judge every week, and they have to live in a restrictive halfway house, and, you know, they're drug tested 3 times a week. And it's a different model. Instead of seeing people kind of coming through the revolving door of the court committing crimes to get drug money, help them get better and start their lives over. So we see this every week, and in this one, it's a woman who was doing very well in the drug court and then had a relapse, and she has written a letter to the judge and is going to read it and ask to be let back in. Because the judge, if they get caught, they can be sent to jail and asked to serve their sentence out. So it's a letter, young woman reading a letter.
I've thought long and hard about what I was going to write in this letter. I'm hoping that being honest with you guys will help me, and I know it can't hurt. I want you guys to know that I have honestly tried to stay sober. Every attempt at succeeding in drug court has been sincere in my heart. It absolutely kills me to be standing back in this docket, and I know it kills my family, too. Going to the Edwina Martin House was a great experience. I loved it. I was beginning to develop a life for myself. I got a sponsor, joined a group, started step work, got a job, got very close with my family, started the relationships group, and was able to celebrate my 21st birthday sober and had a blast. I got a taste of what it was like to actually be happy. Regardless of all this, there was still something missing, like there always has been with me. I've thought a lot about what the missing piece is, and in my program, and has been, I believe it's been fully surrendering to AA and all of my old ways.
So that woman is actually now a defendant. She was picked up, she re-violated. This is what happens in courtrooms around this country, that the courts are really the social service agencies of last resort. And it's a role of the court that the public generally doesn't have a true sense of. And by being in the courts and sort of providing this ongoing stream, this is just part of our daily stream, the public gets a sense of the real ills and solutions that come up in court. We see on a daily basis continually people whose landlords were foreclosed on, who weren't paying their rent. Everything sort of makes its way to the courts in one way or another. So it's been really very instructive if you hang in all the time. And I think one of the things we want to talk to you about is how to contextualize on a more continuous basis of what's going on in the court so it's actually useful. I want to talk quickly about a case that we've been involved in for a while, and we've been working with Chris and Jeff and the attorneys from Boston University over a case that came up over Open Courts Archives. As I mentioned, we went online on May 2nd. By May 3rd, the district attorney's office started raising objections to anything that we were putting up on the site. Well, not everything, but a lot of cases, because of the concerns that the cases would appear in our archives. It's important to know that we met with all of the various stakeholders for months. Our first meeting with the stakeholders was in December of 2010. We didn't go online until May 2nd. We also built an advisory board of all the various major constituencies in the state, from the state Supreme Judicial Court to the president of the Mass Bar Association, victims, witness advocates. So we had worked...
And the district attorney.
And the district attorney. I'm not sure. So, and the district attorney, and everybody had a voice as we were discussing how we would actually implement open court. And we anticipated a lot of the pain points and try to get ahead of as many as possible. But just the same, when the reality of what was going on in open court came up, the district attorney's concerns felt that the archives were pushing the boundaries of what they considered to jeopardize people's ability to get a fair trial and sort of be re-victimized. I don't want to characterize the district attorney's point of view, but it was a point of view that was shared by other stakeholders, which we decided that the issues were serious enough to voluntarily we took down the archives while we discussed the best way to go about it. We set up a committee with all the various stakeholders. There were members of this group in this room. Jeff Hermes was involved in that group, representing the Citizens Media Law Project. And we also had representatives from the district attorney's office, the AG's office. And there was a real effort over a period of 3 weeks of how we could maintain, get our archives up, but at the same time, respect the rights of those who come before the court. Many of those people come before the court involuntarily, that they are foisted on the courts as victims or in other cases where they didn't have their control of it. So after 3 weeks, we came up with guidelines on how the public could get access to the archives. Rather than put up the archives at the end of a day, we set up a two-day waiting period, and this was agreed upon by consensus of the working group on access to archives. We asked people to register. They had to give us a valid email. We also said that people, we would make it difficult for people to copy our video. And even after that two-day period, we set up a mechanism for people to get access, to let us know if there were issues that we weren't aware of at the time, and we would make an effort to take it down. This is a pilot project. We felt that we were making the best effort to, you know, work with the courts and work with the various constituencies because we wanted to sort of demonstrate best practices that could be copied around the country. Despite our best efforts, there was a case where a defense attorney mentioned mentioned the name of a victim of a sexual crime. A minor victim of a sexual crime. They gave the name of her school, names of relatives, all sorts of other information. Open court voluntarily said we would not post that information to the archives. The case, though, continued to go forward through the court system. The district attorney's office and others felt that it was the court's right to order us not to post these archives. And despite our assurances we would not post them, they wanted to take the editorial control from a news organization, and we claim prior restraint. We can talk more about that case if you like, but it's only one part of what we're doing in open court. Moving forward, there's an awful lot of challenges that open courts faces, both technical and engagement-wise, and I thought it would be good for Joe to talk about those.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, a huge part of the project, we just want to illuminate how the justice system works, not so much just drop in footage like some TV stations can do. So one of the main challenges in doing this every day is how to manage that fire hose of data and just streaming every day and finding value in all that footage. It's all there, but it's not really practical or iterable to have a producer in the room every day and the energy to edit footage and tag footage. So we've been exploring some social mediation, citizen moderators, things like that. There's legitimate privacy issues that mitigate things like searchability. You know, do we want to put people's names out there? It's public, but do we want to make it searchable? You know, how that relates to a new meaning of online identity. Everyone is innocent until proven guilty, but if an employer is Googling you, you know, what does that mean?
I mean, one of the, just to sort of build on Joe's point for a second, is we thought one of the lowest hanging fruit opportunities for this was just to post the daily docket so people could see what was going on in their community. But people's names are in that daily docket, and it's provided, it's posted on the door at the court every day. It is a public document. But we ran into real pushback from the state in getting access to that document because of the fact that people's names are in it.
So and the state doesn't post it?
It does not post it online. They post
The federal court posts the docket online, although it disappears after 2 days. So if you don't grab it, it's not available. You can't go back and look at it.
So that's interesting. So this is one of our challenges. We thought, as you know, we're sort of building a Cadillac of demonstration. We have a live camera. We have producers in the courtroom. But what we're hoping to do is propagate ways for this to be copied around the state, do it in an economical way that could be iterated throughout. And we thought at least at the lowest level, people could just post and see what's going on in their daily court. The most we're able to do right now is post where the judges are and what the judges are hearing that day. Go ahead, Joe.
Right. That's okay. Sure. So we're figuring that out. That was a big part of the project where there wasn't really an answer. So, you know, we are just kind of wading through that the founders didn't have Google, but they built the courts in the center of town. You know, for a reason, and everybody knew what was going on, and we're trying to serve that, you know, the public's right to know. So we're trying to involve community. We're doing a collaborative coverage event this coming Monday, just kind of a day in the life of the court. We're in first session every day, but there's several other courtrooms that we can't be in, so we thought it'd be interesting to get citizen journalists, whoever is interested, assign them to a courtroom and trade notes at the end of the day and just look at everything that the court did in one day. And this will be the first event, maybe of a few, and we'll see what comes out of that. But that's one experiment we're doing. Another one to provide some additional context is open court briefs, calling some representative cases, cases we see a lot of. That's just one example. I'll let Val talk about that.
Yeah, so we're just pulling, kind of based on the legal threat database here, where it's just, we want to get a bulk number of cases of, say, larcenies or domestic assault and battery or drug possession and, you know, Class C drug distribution, things that we see a lot of, and just edit them down and not annotate them very much, just tag them with hearing type, what the charge is, and who the judge was. And so people can see how different judges deal with the same kind of case or how this kind of case is dealt with across a breadth of cases, just to allow people to kind of study it and see patterns in it and start to ask questions. So that's going to be launching soon. But we're just trying to figure out how much context to provide because it's pretty work intensive to be cutting and uploading and tagging, and, you know, I put a little narrative in it. So kind of how do we involve viewers, or what do we want them to get out of this or start asking about? And can they help us tag cases? Can they help us in any way? Because we have some devoted viewers, definitely.
And you know, sort of there's lots of questions and a few answers that we've discovered along the way, but one of the real challenges of going forward with open court, the Knight News Foundation funded us for 1 year, and though we've had a lot of interesting conversations about what this program offers and how it can grow, it is not on its face value currently sustainable. And one of the things we thought we would want to be talking to this group and others out there is your thoughts about sustainability. And another question and another challenge for us, which goes along with the sustainability, is how to get scale. We are likely to add a courtroom going forward, maybe more than one courtroom at the state level. We've gotten interest from the JAVS network, which provides audio and video services for the state of Massachusetts and other states around the country. We've also had some very informal talks with other companies that are in this space who see this as a potential opportunity. They've been able to figure out how to do a Switch Live camera pool. What they haven't really figured out is convincing jurisdictions around the country of posting this information up on archives, or even being able to do it, you know, on a live basis, which is what we are doing.
Kentucky actually uses their video as their official public record. So there's other jurisdictions that are doing interesting things.
You know, so we're just sort of working our way through these questions. We're hoping to have questions from you folks. We didn't want to get into the nitty-gritty of the project, but we're happy to answer every question that you can think about it. One of the first questions is, how do we get our audio? We actually plug into the court's audio, which we did it because we felt that this would be a cheaper, more iterative way than WBUR coming in and stringing microphones. So there is already a digital recording capacity at the Quincy District Court. We patch into that. This digital recording equipment is fairly new. It's in the last decade in the District Court of Massachusetts. But that seems to us the best entree to make this sort of, you know, if they can do audio, digital audio of the nation's courts, it seems that video is really just a natural progression, though there is some skepticism that given the financial challenges of the judicial system in general, getting a camera in the courtroom would be a challenge, in every courtroom would be a real challenge. But I guess what our message has been is this is an inevitability. I think that's the sense that Justice Cordy on the state Supreme Judicial Court, who's also a member of our board, feels strongly about. He would rather discover the pain points before this happens to be ahead of it and sort of keep Massachusetts ahead of the curve.
They would record it to a CD, and then you can ask for it. Any media or citizen can ask for it, yeah. And then it takes...
That's the official public record. They don't have a court recorder. In Massachusetts.
Massachusetts, yeah. And many courts around the country. You'll see less and less those people at right. The stenography, court reporters. They're in short supply as well, and sort of recording is an easier way to do it in a more cost-effective way.
So are most of the objections, so it seems like there's two jumps that you make. One is the video, and one is the public access. So, which do you see as the key fight? Like, they said, okay, well, we can't have the video, so we can put all this audio up on the web. Would that satisfy what you're interested in, or?
I think nobody, what's interesting, even with the court case, and I think your question's a really good one, we have not really gotten as much pushback over the live stream. It's primarily over the archives. I think camera and video have become so ubiquitous that it's less of a barrier than it may have once been. So I'm not sure that's the real issue.
I can jump
yeah,
in,
please do, Jeff.
One of the distinctions, which is sort of key here, is the official recording as a court record, which is subject to impoundment orders and other measures taken by the court to restrict access, as opposed to a recording which is in the hands of a private organization like Open Court. And whether or not the court should have the same rights to control access to that information when it's in these guys' hands as opposed to when it's the court's own official record.
How did you pick Quincy? I know that you probably would be denied anything in the Boston courts with the reputation that some of those courts have. How was Quincy chosen as opposed to any other court in Massachusetts?
I think the questions are picked up by the mics around the table. But why Quincy?
Yeah.
It's a great question. We had the unanimous support of something called the Supreme Judicial Court Media Judiciary Committee, which is in Massachusetts, which is made up of members of the bar, members of the court, and members of the media, where it's an opportunity to talk off the record about issues that come up. In November of 2009, there was a unanimous vote to support Open Court. When it seemed likely that the Knight Foundation was actually interested and we became a finalist for the News Challenge, we had to figure out where this was going to go. And in a meeting with the Supreme Judicial Court Media Judiciary Committee, it was suggested that we try the Quincy District Court. Quincy District Court has a history of innovation. They're one of the first. They had a drunk driving court way back when. They had victim witness, a lot of things with Judge Kramer in the early 70s and 80s in terms of courtroom innovation came out of the Quincy District Court. That situation has continued with Judge Mark Coven, who's the Chief Justice there, and he was very eager to be part of this project. We did not run into any pushback from the Boston municipal courts, so it's hard for me to even say how it would be received around the Commonwealth, but it was suggested that we do the Quincy District Court. What was nice about the Quincy District Court was that 11,000 cases of a huge variety come through the court. It's one of the busiest. It's close to Boston, and it has a fairly diverse community that it serves, so it met a lot of our needs And especially they had a very willing group of people, both in the clerk's office and the court's office. And you know what? As well as all the other stakeholders in the court, they like the reputation of being an innovative courthouse. And I think people are generally vested and supportive of being out in front of these kinds of issues.
So without a permanent docket and an indexing system, when this kid was accused of the triple murder, how did you find the piece of tape where he'd previously been, bail hadn't been revoked?
We knew which day it was, and we had...
Because you'd remembered, or because...
They said it in the arraignment, mm-hmm. So we just... And we keep notes, so we kind of looked back, and he actually remembered the guy, and...
I recognized him when I saw him. They mentioned the date in court, and then we just went back
scrolled through it and found it.
So right now, it's a limitation. We're only archiving by date. So not by case, by case, by case. This is where we want to get into tagging. Google has offered the Knight Foundation some funding to provide the Knight News Challenge winners with technical solutions that we may not be able to come up with ourselves. Obviously, they've done a lot of work with voice recognition and transcription. We've put in a bid for something like that as an opportunity to better track it, but some of the stuff that Val and Joe are talking about in terms of tagging and creating categories of coverage would be a way to sort of solve some of those issues. Charlie?
It seems to me that what you're up against is the resistance to the idea that the internet should be in the courtroom, that is, that the public should somehow have access. A very substantial judicial bias against that you're starting out to penetrate. Would you say that's your mission? That's kind of like what Knight was hoping you would accomplish for them, to break through to the point where somehow the establishment would see that opening our courts to the public was a positive thing?
I think it was one of the key challenges of this project. And what was interesting is that the support for this project sort of all aligned at once. A lot of the support came from the court itself in Massachusetts. And I think part of that was sort of the real politic. The courts get their funding from the public, and if the public doesn't necessarily understand what the courts are dealing with, it's harder to get their funding. I think they're also very proud of the work they're doing. One of the other things that the court isn't comfortable with is winging it. And a lot of the judges, what we discovered during the time when we were sort of, this idea was bubbling up, that judges were sort of winging it. If it was a quiet day in court, they'd let somebody live tweet and blog from the courtroom if it was quiet, or if it was really quiet, if somebody wanted to hold up their cell phone. So there was this sense of inevitability that we better deal with this. And we've enjoyed incredible support from the state the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts. With respect to that culture, I think the culture, it's understandable. And it's not like the legislature. There's a lot of very sensitive issues that come up in court. And we have, working with our working groups and with our advisory board, taking the approach of walking before we run. Early on, we decided that we didn't want to we agreed with the recommendation of our advisory board not to post domestic violence cases unless there was a criminal complaint associated with that. We did not want to create a situation where victims would not want to come forward. We also worked on some guidelines in protection of witnesses or protection of informants. All of these sort of points that we anticipated and discussed ahead of time. So there's very legitimate concerns, but I feel like the courts in many ways have been very supportive because they think it's inevitable.
Thank you. But if the strategy is to break through, it seems to me it suggests a tactical approach that doesn't involve stretching out to the point where you hit all the pressure points. That is, I mean, why you're not in the entertainment business.
No, we're not.
You're not looking for audience particularly. What you're looking is to convince people that having a camera in the courtroom, it doesn't cause a lot of trouble.
That's right.
And so if you just focused on that point rather than trying to contextualize things and trying to create surroundings, why just on that one point and drove that one through, wouldn't that make sense?
You know, yes and no. I think it's very, you know, we're making the point that we're providing digital access to the courts. At the same time, if you watch this day in and day out, the question of how much caloric value that feed has may not be enough to sustain an idea like this. If we've created a glossary of terms that come up in court, one of the, you know, I see your point. There's other questions. I'll just give you a quick conversation. Judge Cordy was in conversation with I think it was Justice Souter, and I could be wrong, who was very much against, and I don't want to name which, how about a former Supreme Court justice or a Supreme Court justice? I don't want to be wrong on this one. Who really was against the idea and said, you know, over my dead body. And there was a conversation when Judge Cordy said, well, you know, we feel like this is inevitable and we're going to have to do it. And he cited, and whoever this justice was at the Supreme Court, cited Justice Brandeis, who said that the state courts are the laboratories of the court system, and conceded that this would be the place to try something like this. So, you know, we feel like that's sort of the spirit that we're taking in what we're doing.
I don't want to sit here and issue with Professor Nessie, but that's what I'm about to do. Mm-hmm.
It's not allowed.
I'm not a lawyer, so I can do it in ignorance. I mean, just getting a camera in the courtroom, as you say, doesn't have a whole lot of value. The value comes, for instance, in the Boston Globe series a few weeks back, where it went through, you know, all the OUI records and showed that, you know, if you want to get off on a ridiculous defense to drunk driving, take a bench trial on certain judges. I mean, that's where the caloric value seems to be. And, you know, the barrier you seem to be running up against is not so much the internet, but search and discovery. I mean, that's what, you know, people in the court system don't seem to want because of all of the issues it raises. But it's also not different than the legislature. There's a story about when the U.S. Congress started putting its own hearing transcripts online. I mean, they had to go through and excise millions of Social Security numbers that were simply in the, you know, the records that nobody cared about until they were online and find them. So, I mean, there are other battles like this. I guess to put this in the form of a question, I mean, is your ultimate goal to be able to do something like the Boston Globe series, but, you know, provide the video, you know, extract the video transcripts of those trials so that you can actually see the judge, you know, doing something ridiculous and stupid?
Well, it wouldn't just, or something courageous and very thoughtful. I wouldn't want to characterize judges'
opinions are my own
that way. I think it would be terrific to provide a way for stories to be told. I greatly admired the work of the Boston Globe that went through folder by folder the record of what was going on in the court. Ideally, something like open court would make that easier, and our challenges are getting our arms around that data in a usable way that would not compromise people's rights to privacy, but allow the public to have a better understanding of what's going on in the court. Go ahead.
probably aware of that, but the European Court of Justice in Strasbourg started to video stream its public sessions 2 or 3 years ago. So maybe that would be an interesting case study also of best practices. So they have committed to some standards, so they are streaming public sessions, they don't stream anything that could But as maybe could be an interesting case study also to earn legitimacy or arguing grounds, because that has kicked off a discussion in Europe to what extent should streaming from courts be allowed. And you see that more and more countries, like the UK and the Netherlands, start to tend to allow these kind of mobile phone-enabled reporting techniques.
To confirm, what kind of cases do they stream?
Public. They have to be public.
Just criminal, everyday people?
Yeah, everything which involves a public hearing. So you have some cases that are kept non-public, particularly if minors are involved, so they wouldn't stream that, obviously. But everything that is in public, they say, well, the public has a right to see that, and the public is online these days. So which also answers a bit the question of sustainability, and because what these initiatives shows that sustainable, eventually they need to be embraced by the courts themselves, because they have to be the motors behind it. So it would be also interesting thing to study.
Yeah, no, I think that would be helpful. Do you know if they archive the cases as well?
As far as I know, they also, at least the European Court of Justice has an archive, yeah.
No, that would be interesting.
Yeah. I also checked on the ICC in Hague.
Yes.
Their court proceedings are available on video the following day. And if something is sensitive, they go in camera and they tell the public. Also, I think in Virginia, they started open video court proceedings, I think, about maybe 10 years ago. So you could perhaps check also on that. The other thing is, as far as the state is concerned, maybe you could look for a way for people to vote. You look for signatures for people to vote for it as one of the aspects in changing the laws in the state, and so that you can also have maybe funding from the state.
Well, you know, you raise a couple of interesting points. One is that the appellate court and the state supreme judicial court in Massachusetts are live streamed. Those cases are live streamed right now, and it was somewhat ironic that the hearing that involved open courts live streaming was live streamed in the state supreme court. So there are examples close to home. And yes, they are archived as well and accessible. The other point is that what I imagined, I think, when I initially pulled this proposal, was there was never anything in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s, there was never anything like a victim witness advocate that was sort of funded by LEAP money, as I recall. It was a federal grant. And now that is part of the court system. You wouldn't think that there wouldn't be a victim witness advocate role in the state courts. I think we all envision that at some point in the future there will be a media access mediator in the courts that could balance the rights of a person's right to privacy with the rights of a fair trial. I don't think those days are too far away.
In terms of transparency and getting people to access this material that is certainly valuable for comparison purposes or many other purposes. What's the value added, as we saw in the videos that you just showed, to have the name and faces of the convicted people explicitly, if it is explicitly stated in those archived records? If the goal is to have the process, not the people, visible for the public. So what's the value added? I don't have a clear idea on this, but my guess would be that this could be far more problems and issues as regards to what it actually brings in terms of visibility and what you are willing to achieve with this. What do you think about, what's your feeling on
that? About shrouding identity?
Yeah, what's the value added of knowing who is who specifically, as opposed to just displaying the process?
Do you want to take a stab at that one?
I don't know. I mean, it's a public courtroom. It's sort of the baseline thing we keep going back to. You know, someone else could be sitting there and watching that person too, and we're just sort of rebroadcasting that. And what is, you know, to bounce it back to you, what is the difference between the public and not streaming?
It's the principle of the thing.
Yeah, I mean,
and
I think it's more than that.
Well, the
idea is valid reasons for not having secret courts.
Right. I mean,
right.
In this particular context, having the identity available allows you to track, you know, the same defendant who's coming before the case on different matters, just like we saw with the example earlier, and see how one case is falling through from situation to situation.
You could still identify without displaying the names.
Right. But
it came to me, Justice Cordy made this point as well, where if you sort of bow to that, then it's almost a concession to the innocence of proven guilty credence, where, you know, is it a failure of our citizens to understand our system that if they appear in court that they're guilty? We're trying to inform them of the process and show these people, and, you know, if we get cameras in every courtroom and show the entire picture and then the person is innocent, then they can understand the whole process better.
It's sort of the general principle of allowing people to be present physically in the courtroom is because there are intangibles which you don't get from bare news reports. You actually see the conduct of, you know, you hear the questions, you see the ways in which the witnesses respond, you see the ways in which defendants respond, and it provides a layer of information which you can't get without.
But I think that's a very good point, and I think one of the things that's worth thinking about is it is a very easy leap to make from the very local public of saying, well, we put the courtrooms in the middle of the village and everyone in town could go there because that's public, but it's not a global public and it's not a public for posterity. And so I think if you want to look at,
right,
you don't want to necessarily say, okay, we're going to make a heavy-handed thing and say only people in Quincy can access this, but I think it may be worthwhile to think about a nuanced set of public. And you want to make it more public. For instance, want to see the proceedings. There's this dangers in secret courts. There's just a series of New York Times about how secret family court in New York has become. But you may want to say, well, we want to make it more public, but the public permanent archived internet is extremely public. And so there may be a way of adjusting the public to something that gets the results you want. And one slice on that might be the identity slice, to say, we can see the people's reactions, we can follow a pseudonym through the courts over time, we can follow a lot of things, but maybe we can hide faces, we can maybe move where the camera is. Maybe there may be some things to think about saying, when we want to use just audio and have, you know, some very interesting visualization or animation that shows a lot of things but doesn't reveal other things. So I think thinking about where do you want to open to public without it being just completely open public, and there's slices that may be more conceptual than just distance.
Right, and that speaks to the guidelines that we tried to set up too, with a 2-day delay in case there's a not doing domestic hearings out of abundance of caution in case it would dissuade victims from coming forward, things like that. So, I mean, we're trying to approach it in a cautious way.
Yeah, I think your question's really good one, as is yours. And, you know, given, you know, the folks who are in this room, I'd like to sort of throw that idea out to the room on the gains versus losses, the sort of a nuanced approach to privacy, and let's not lose track of the practical challenges of doing something like that. So I'd be curious to get people's sense of that. Go ahead.
As a citizen, I'm sitting here feeling very frustrated because I don't feel like you're taking on sort of the attitude I expect from the Fourth Estate which is one of uncovering information and making it public, it feels to me like you've already been co-opted by the institutions you're trying to make transparent. I mean, in many other, you know, traditional reporting environments, you know, the reporter would be saying, why is privacy my problem? You know, or why is secrecy my problem? I report the facts as I find them.
Do I understand right that you are standing and fighting on some First Amendment issue?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Why are you standing and fighting on a First Amendment issue?
I think I'll get both questions. I think we've moved away from that one, but I want to answer that one right now because I think it's an important one. Again, this is a pilot program. Our concern on the First Amendment issue was we did not want to set a precedent for other news organizations going forward who might be ordered by the state to edit their own material. Our argument was that this material was gathered in open court. It was up to the news organization to have a right to decide what was going in, and rather than cede the editorial rights of that information to the state, that was an important thing to defend, and especially in the case of a pilot program for something that could have implications going forward, we felt that was a really important issue. To your point, in terms of sort of the co-opt nature of the project, I think if we had taken somewhat, and I don't want to use the word militant, but a more aggressive approach to working with the courts, I'm not sure we would have been able to go as far as we have in as short a period as of time that we have. I think this has been pointed out in this room. This is a part of the branch of the market of this country that is least accessible. And we made the judgment by sort of working within and without the system, bringing constituents from both sides. Citizen journalists are on our advisory board, as well as district attorneys. And we felt that we needed to sort of listen to all the voices going forward. And I feel like the progress of this project has sort of been demonstrated by that approach. Jack.
One of the things I'm not hearing is about the actual, why are they in court? They're in court because a crime is committed, a judgment's rendered. Now the defendant or the prosecution has a right to appeal that. Before, they would take the tapes, they would purchase the tape from the court, hire a court stenographer to make a transcript, and then write 15 briefs, one for each eye of the appellate court, and on and on. To try to describe what happened in the court and why the judge was wrong. You've just given them a video where they can show, and I already know from being in the business, video is more powerful than anything as far as persuading and biasing or whatever you want to call it. And the question is, has that been in giving you the right at the in the courts to do this? Are there any restrictions on the attorneys using those videos that you make as justification for their appeal, or as part of their appeal process? Has that come up?
We have not been asked for those videos. If they're posted online publicly and they're publicly accessible, it just hasn't come up. So rather than answer the hypothetical, I'll defer. How about that? I think Jeff's probably happy if I did that.
I think as a prosecutor in Taiwan, I find myself in a dilemma of pro or against this kind of a live stream in the court. I would 100% pro this program only if the camera projected to everybody except me, because I think it would be more distracting. For instance, I might be more caring about what I'm going to wear today if I know this is a live stream, for instance. And my question is that, is everybody in the court just like witness? In their subpoena, is there anything
stated that this would be live stream port for them.
There's notices all over them, and they're every microphone.
Yeah, I mean, if I were a witness, I'm going to get cross examination report. Do I know that today I'm going to in the court that it would be live stream?
If you are in the courtroom that we currently have wired, you would be very well aware of it as you walk in the door. We used illustrations for those people who English is not the first language, even posting up from the dock where defendants are held before their hearing on the staircase up. It is made clear. Right now in Quincy, since we're only in one courtroom, there is some flexibility if there are issues that the case can be heard at another court. But just in terms of the stakeholders, I think this was a lot of the conversation. You know, the district attorneys were worried that the defense attorneys may not want to settle, or vice versa, or it would have an impact on the actual way the cases were being handled in court. And we haven't had a big enough sample yet to see the actual impact of the camera, but that was openly talked about along the way. Go ahead, see either one of you.
Yeah, kind of on that score, I guess the first I was thinking was it'd be interesting to see a study of how, or at least a comparison of how a judge has handled cases before and after the camera was introduced, to see if it affects his or her, that the notion that the public might be out there watching might affect his or her approach to, and for that matter, the prosecutors and defendants. Secondly, I was thinking about how your record competes with the public record. So recently I had occasion to try to find something in the district court, and I had to send somebody over there because I'm fortunate enough to get to send somebody over there. And we had to write a check for I don't remember what it was, but it was exorbitant for basically a copy of a CD-ROM, which then came back, and then I had to basically just kind of fiddle around and try to find what I needed in the session because it wasn't annotated, it wasn't managed in any reasonable way. So I guess my thoughts are is that, I wondered whether you have had or would expect to have pushback from the folks in the court who make a public record and charge a significant sum of money for either to sustain what they do or to deal with the larger problems of a cash-strapped state judicial system, whether there might be pushback from courts because you're offering something that could be a lot more useful and accessible, first of all, and also whether the courts might see a project like this as an opportunity to sort of offload that work and either step back from it or invite a project like yours to develop the public record, which would be the very definition of being co-opted. But have you seen any indications from the folks who work in that side of the court on the public record how they feel about this project?
You're in the court every day.
I don't think there is because we're not the official record. No, nobody would trust us, take our recording and use it in there. They always go to the public record, the official one, to get their official record because maybe there's some difference between ours and they need to use that one. So I don't feel like there's been any friction of any kind.
But we do know, we personally know the clerk who's in charge of going through those, and it's a mountain of work. There's a constant bottleneck of requests. They're certainly overloaded.
Sure.
So going back to your first point, I don't know any evidence, obviously, of a change before and after the records get public, but there is actually some recent research showing that if you have similar cases, you have systematic biases in the sentences and the judgment according to the judge who is judging the case. So you have recent data sets that have been collected in this regard.
And the time of day.
Yeah. So, and this could definitely help. I think my current sense of what you're trying to do is just that, put the process publicly available so that anybody can see it. And going back to the problem of identifying the specific people who are convicted, so my first idea would be that, you know, there is some, so at least in Europe, there is some value of time and forgiveness, and that after you have been sentenced and you do jail time, when you go back, you are supposed to live a normal life. So if it's really easy to retrieve what you have done online for anybody to see within your community, this may make it harder. And so what's the purpose of making 10 years in jail if you're still sentenced after that throughout your life? And then the second thing is, so this may be totally off, I don't know if I'm right on this, I don't know anything about this, but the trial is an ecosystem in its own right. So it's a physical place where people interact with one another. So psychologically, opening totally that space without any boundaries may perhaps have an effect on the way people testify and on the way they interact with one another. This may be some question to ask to a judge, actually. I don't know anything, but I would be really interested in this. So,
you could make the same argument for an open press, right?
Oh, yeah, sure. It's just like thoughts. I don't have any answers in there. So.
Yeah, no, I think, love to hear it.
So we haven't really seen people playing to the camera, or, I mean, we don't know judgment-wise whether the judges are doing anything differently, but I've been surprised at how much people just don't even know. It's a very small camera, you know, it's not a big one, and people don't seem to be playing to it or, you know, pleading out less or doing any of that kind of stuff that we had thought maybe would be happening. So that's been kind of surprising that there's been none of that.
So it seems to me that streaming is no different than public access, I mean, walking into the courtroom.
That's correct.
So that really doesn't really impact status quo, it sounds like, but archiving does.
Right.
And as Jack said, there's a real difference between seeing live video. So 20 years out, if somebody knows, you know, has to admit that they were arrested for drunk driving, you know, that's a fact, but going back and being able to see it is a very different thing. So there's a bunch of, you know, that's actually what's made the internet so different, is things suddenly become permanent. And there's a bunch of research projects that look at giving fading memory to internet archives. And,
yeah,
you know, that would be something to be interesting to look at. I mean, obviously, it's imperfect. Somebody could grab all your archives and, right, and you know, store them. But you're going to have such a huge quantity of data that's really, you know, unless you know what it is you want to save, most stuff isn't going to get saved. So it might be interesting to look at the idea of fading memory, you know, whether, you know, things degrade over time or disappear at some point, you know, just that they're not permanent forever. And that might make it an easier sell.
Although you could see in certain circumstances why being able to actually see a, you know, a 20-year-old kid in court on a DUI.
Total valuable.
No, but you know, if you're talking about a 40-year-old who mm-hmm. who was forced to admit that at one point in his distant past he was convicted for a DUI, and then you see the kid, maybe it's in some circumstances you can tell the difference between the skinny kid who's standing in the courtroom and the person who's before you right now and get a better sense of the time, as opposed to that just being a bare mm-hmm. fact which is attached to this person indefinitely.
But you deny the right to spin it also. I mean, you know, well, it's the one thing that's very different from the current scenario is anybody can go and see it, and then somebody can describe it years later any way they want, and somebody can disagree. Now you have this objective record, and if you really wanted to not change the status quo too much, you'd have some sort of degradation of memory, both digital and physical, over time.
I mean, of course, cameras have been going into courtrooms and recording proceedings for a long time. It's just the volume that's different in that scale.
Yeah, and it's the courts have never believed in privacy through obscurity, except for themselves. But if you actually look at the Supreme Court's decisions where things were put on the internet and people tried to argue about privacy through obscurity, they totally disregard, they do not, I mean, if it's public, by flying to Nome, Alaska and going in between 4 and 5 in the afternoon to the police station, then putting it on the internet doesn't change anything according to the courts. But the reality is that's not true at all.
Well, one quick point on the faded memory. I think I'm correct in saying this, that the state courts runs into a storage issue with their audio files from the district court, and they only hold them for a specific period of time. And I can't remember what that is. It's just What is it?
Six.
Yeah, years.
The last I heard. They destroy evidence after the final appeal. Once the SJC, you know, if you don't go to the Supreme Court, I mean, they just can't store everything forever. So things don't last forever.
So in terms of degradation of memory and degradation of our data over time, it's an interesting conversation and an interesting idea for us to think about and consider.
Do you think you'd get different pushback if hypothetically had the Google, you know, voice-to-text software, and instead of doing video, you were just simply storing transcripts as archives?
I think video is... I think Google, you know, if there was something like this, there would be an inevitable pushback on getting the name wrong or misidentifying someone. I think it opens up its...
It was completely accurate.
I think video obviously does change people's perception. I think it's as time passes, and again, it's, you know, this conversation is being videotaped. More and more of our lives are chronicled on videotape all the time. I think over time, that will be less of a boundary breaker, and this is just the first step in that direction. So maybe it is right now. As time passes, even less so. But again, we're both talking in hypothetical, so we're both on safe ground.
Is there anything you guys would like to see us do or try?
Well, it would be interesting if, when people access this, since people are watching it, you might give them the opportunity to tag it and look and see whether the tags look valuable or not.
Crowdsource tagging?
Yeah. I mean, anybody who looks at it, give them the opportunity to tag, you know, tied to time, and see. I mean, you don't have to save the tags and make them public, but you can at least play the experiment to see if that would be valuable or not.
Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. I think one of the things that we never got into in this conversation, and our time is starting to run short, is we do not allow live commenting on our site because we wanted to sort of avoid running, you know, commentary of people who want to take pot shots at either, you know, any of the participants in the process. We do allow people to, you know, participate in moderated blogs and send us their thoughts, but we just don't allow live commenting.
It would be good if you could get into some of the courts where defendants aren't represented by counsel, like housing courts and other places like that.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, I know.
And I think that's just another great area for us to offer
that
insight and accountability that, you know, and ensure, you know, process.
Let me just mention one other thing. If you want to see that how people react, they're on television all the time and they don't care, watch the city council meetings here in Cambridge. They do not. The television has nothing to do with what they
do. I think people gradually just forget.
They just forget about it.
I've seen that within the first week almost. Yeah. They just forget we're there.
Yeah. So I think the one challenge, and it's exciting for us to talk about like where this project can go, and there's lots of work for us to do going forward. Our challenge where we're starting is how do we keep this going forward? So there's not really enough time to discuss that here right now, but, you know, welcome, you know, your ideas and your thoughts about that if you think it's a worthwhile project to go forward.
Maybe you need to do another one of these so we can come back.
More, another one of these. That would be a pleasure, Jack. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Go ahead, Doc. Picked up on this? I mean, do you have any copycats out there so
far? We don't have copycats, but, you know, it's been an interesting year of having the opportunity to talk about this project in a lot of very interesting forums, from before the House of Delegates here in Massachusetts to the 8th, you know, there was a conference on the courts and privacy at the University of William and Mary not too long ago that I was able to participate in. There were some forums sponsored by the American Bar Association in Arizona, where, you know, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was the keynote speaker. So there's been opportunities to talk about where this project is going and some of the ground that's been laid by it. But as far as copycats, we get a lot of questions all the time as, oh, we'd love to do it in our court too. Hmm. But nothing that I know of, really.
There's a lot of, like, mission overlap with the open data, open government. Mm-hmm. But nothing quite like what we're doing that we've seen.
Thanks so much for doing this, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.